The clerk will call the docket. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, esteemed justices. May it please the court, I am Colleen Quinn and I represent Doug Pike. I would like to note that I would like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal at the outset. Your Honors, in the briefs, I believe the parties got down somewhat in the weeds in this matter, and for a moment I would like to take a step back from that and look at the big picture. The citizens of this Commonwealth and the attorneys who represent them need some clear guidance from this court on when a low-level employee, like an attending nurse or a respiratory therapist or an assisting technician, is going to be held responsible or not have any responsibility at all for their negligent acts because they work at a state-run or county-run or city-run facility. And we need to know, is it going to be different if they're treated at MCV or if they're treated at UVA or if they're treated at Southside Regional Medical Center or elsewhere?
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Could
yes,
you
sir.
Have filed the Virginia Tort Claims Act suit against the Commonwealth in this case?
Your Honor, we addressed that in our reply brief. That is a good question. In this case, the Commonwealth is really not liable, and nor was Dr. Campbell. It was the nurse at issue that caused my client to slump over not just once, but twice, and caused Dr. Campbell's surgery to fail in its entirety. So there really was no reason to bring suit against the Commonwealth in that regard. And so that really wasn't an adequate remedy.
So would be no vicarious liability between the nurse and the state-owned run hospital?
Your Honor, the nurse holds the malpractice insurance. The nurse holds, first of all, the Tort Claims Act has a limited remedy. But in addition to that,
Let me just ask you this. If the nurse were negligent,
yes,
would respondent superior make the state hospital liable under general tort principles?
Yes, it could, Your Honor.
So if the state hospital was liable, you could sue the state hospital for the liability caused by the employees of the state hospital through the Virginia Tort Claims Act and sue the state itself.
Your Honor, the problem is that in these cases, one of the things that's claimed is the treatment that's rendered to the patient. And so the initial $100,000 in the Virginia Tort Claims Act is used up by the lien that's taken by the Commonwealth.
Well, that's
so there
a different
is no
question.
Effective remedy.
Yeah, that's a different question, though, whether or not whether your claim is higher than the cap or whether it's been eaten up by other liens. But in theory, there is a recovery in this case. The recovery is under the State Tort Claims Act against the employer, which is a state-run hospital.
Yes and no, Your Honor, because the respondeat superior theory is questionable. In this case, Dr. Campbell would have said that the nurse completely disregarded his instructions, that he completely caused his surgery to fail in its entirety. And there is the practical aspect of why to bring the action at all if it's going to be eaten up by the liens of the Commonwealth. Thank you, Your Honor. So I would like to pull back and look at the overall purposes of sovereign immunity as pointed out by the appellant in her brief in citing Messina. In Messina, the purposes of sovereign immunity are 1, to protect the public purse, 2, the smooth operation of government, 3, to eliminate public inconvenience and danger that might spring from officials being fearful to act, 4, assure citizens will take public jobs, 5, prevent citizens from improperly influencing the conduct of government affairs through the threat or use of vexatious litigation. And I submit that none are at issue here. The public purse is not at risk. It's not implemented. There's no issue with the smooth operation of government. We're not chasing a felon or putting out a fire in this instance. There's no issue of public inconvenience or a danger from an official being fearful to act. There's no issue with not having nurses taking jobs at state-run facilities versus private facilities. And there's no issue with the improper influence of in the conduct of government affairs. Messina also says to accomplish the purpose of the doctrine of sovereign immunity, the doctrine must be extended not only to officials at the highest levels of the three branches of government, but also to some of those who help run the government. That's understandable. It explains why principals and public school teachers have been held immune. However, Messina goes on to note that, quote, general agreement breaks down, however, the further one moves away from the higher levels of government.
I apologize for interrupting once again, but to climb back into the weeds of this case, the trial judge's letter opinion appeared to make factual findings. In fact, one of the factual findings is, according to the trial judge, convincing evidence suggests that if there had been such a specific order to keep the head upright, it would have been in the actual written orders by the physician. Am I mistaking it? But I don't see any assignment of error in this case complaining that the trial judge made factual findings in the letter opinion after telling both of you during the evidentiary hearing that he was assuming everything to be true.
Your Honor, we pointed out in our reply brief that the standard of review is de novo, and the standard of review involves both questions of mixed law and fact. And in this case, the findings made by the trial court are abundantly inconclusive. If the court looks at the findings in the court's letter opinion, and we recited these in the reply brief, the court does not make distinct findings of fact. Here are the findings of fact that the court makes. In fact, when the court talks about at the hearing that it will accept for purposes of true the sign that was over my client's head that his parents would have testified to, Judge Root basically says, the plaintiff says this, the defendant says that, and he never says that, but for purposes of this argument, I'm going to accept as true, as he did at the hearing, that there was a sign over my client's head. Throughout his opinion, he vacillates in terms of his factual findings. He basically has two contradictory statements where he says at Joint Appendix 426, the orders say the nurses not to apply any pressure to Pike's right neck head area. And then later on he says that the orders on April 18th instruct her to keep the head of bed elevated and avoid pressure to the plaintiff's head and neck. So he's got inconsistent findings in his own opinion that are throughout his opinion. That said, Your Honor, from the findings he does make in his opinion, it's very clear that at a minimum he finds that in the factual background that, quote, at Joint Appendix 420, Pike's head and neck were to remain in a particular upright manner in order to facilitate healing. And, quote, on at least two occasions, his head and neck shifted out of position, causing injury and further surgery, allegedly due to the fault of Hageman, who, quote, failed to follow physician instructions with regard to her patient. He goes on to note that at JA 426, the progress notes say on three occasions, Pike's head must be kept in a neutral position, no pressure on the right side of the patient's face and neck. And the orders also say not to apply pressure to Pike's right neck and head area. And this patient was found slumped over the bed rail twice, right on the area where there was the venous compromise, and it stopped the blood flow, and it completely caused the surgery to fail. So you can find from his letter opinion, although it's not very well written, that those fundamental facts were made. However, we would ask the court to go beyond the letter opinion because his fact finding is very inconclusive within the letter opinion and somewhat contradictory. We would ask the court to also look at the transcript. And we would note that the appellee cited numerous times to the transcript throughout their brief, including admitting to the standing order by Dr. Sarcia that was in place, and this is at JA 274-75.
Let me ask you this. Under the standard of review, wouldn't we look at the facts in the light most favorable to the prevailing party? So to the extent there's arguable inconsistencies, doesn't that hurt you as appellant?
Your Honor, this was a plea in bar, and so it is the burden of the appellee to have established the plea conclusively. And so we would argue that no, that standard does not apply here, that to the contrary, that we've got to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff in this regard. And because it is a question of mixed law, in fact, and because Judge Roop does not make a very clearly concise ruling with regard to factual findings, we believe this court does have to look at the transcript. Moreover, with all respect to Judge Roop, his letter opinion is somewhat disingenuous when he says at trial, for purposes of my ruling, I am going to accept, Ms. Quinn, your proffer is true. There was a sign over the bed that there was an order in place.
Kind of led you down the primrose.
Yes, sir. So thank you, Judge McCullough, Justice McCullough. So proceeding forward.
On this factual question, though, couldn't you have asked for a jury on finding the facts?
Your Honor, we really didn't feel that a jury was necessary. If you look at the case law that's out there with regard to nursing, and if you look at Judge Roop's prior ruling with regard to determining that we didn't even need to have an expert in this case because the matter was so common sense that the nurse was clearly negligent based on what we had alleged, that we felt like a jury would just compound the matter, that we could get a clear ruling from Judge Roop with regard to this issue. Moreover, I would submit to the court that the James versus Jane analysis is incredibly complex. I suffer analysis paralysis every time I dive into this case. And I don't think James versus Jane works for lower-level employees. I think a lot of the opinion itself and what's in the opinion applies, but I don't think the four-factor analysis works.
I don't disagree with you, but where do we go with that? We don't have any, it's stare decisis. We don't have any briefing on any alternatives.
I think you can work from James versus Jane. I think you've got to work.
Then do so, if you would.
Yes, sir.
Presumably, we're not going to throw it out. Use that analysis, particularly points 1 and 2, in the next minute or so.
Thank you, Justice Millett. I think if the court looks at the...
Justice Millett accepts your apology.
Excuse me, Justice Millett. I'm sorry. And you are on the bench. You're not retired.
That's all right, Attorney Locke. It's fine.
Justice Winsome, I'm a little under the weather. I feel like I'm moving at the speed of a rickshaw. If the court looks at James versus Jane and not the four-factor analysis, because in all honesty, factors 3 and 4 completely cut against each other for a low-level employee, as pointed out by Judge Roop. But if the court looks at the language that says, quote, the state is of course interested and concerned that patients who are treated at the University Hospital receive proper medical care. However, the state has this same concern for every patient who's treated in any private hospital or by any doctor throughout the Commonwealth. That rings true for nurses. But James versus Jane also goes on to talk about, while there may have been a time when a physician was attracted to teach in a state medical school and to serve as an attending physician on the staff at its hospital because of the cloak of the immunity, that has changed. That has changed for nurses, too. The court goes on to state that the only issue here is whether we're going to allow this physician to be immune from negligence. And the court goes on to state that basically, no, we're not. A medical provider is to do no wrong. And we're going to make sure that doctors are held accountable and that a failure to use such care, quote, a failure to use such care in the treatment of patients is a violation of their duty to the patients and a departure from a condition of their employment. And that applies to nurses just as well. A physician, quote, a physician who fails to use reasonable care in the treatment of a patient acts at his own risk and is not entitled to invoke the doctrine of sovereign immunity. That should be the same for nurses. They should be held to the same standard. Otherwise, the citizens of this Commonwealth, especially indigent citizens, get lesser care. Your Honor, I would like to reserve my remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is William Schumann. I'm the counsel for the appellee, Catherine Hageman. At the counsel table with me is my partner, Tracy Hayes. In addressing the issues in this case, I think it's important to keep in mind the context from which the facts in this case arose. Mr. Pike was in the surgical trauma intensive care unit precisely because he was considered to be among the sickest of the sick. In fact, he was so sick that his post-operative care required minute-to-minute management. In short, Mr. Pike was an ongoing human emergency. The threshold question is the standard of review, and we respectfully disagree with Ms. Pike's counsel in saying that somehow on appeal, Ms. Hageman has the burden and the evidence should be construed against her, the prevailing party. It is a mixed question of law and fact, and as this court has repeatedly said, While it reviews the legal questions de novo, all the factual findings are given the weight of a jury verdict, and all the evidence and all the reasonable inferences therefrom are construed in the light of the prevailing party, in this case, Ms. Hageman.
So it does seem a little unfair that you go through this hearing and the transcript repeats over and over again the trial judge saying, look, you know, I'll accept what you have to say as a proffer, I'll accept it, arguendo is true. And leaves, my reading of it is he leaves both counsel believing that he's going to accept everything as is in the nature of a proffer.
No, I don't think that's what the court was saying. And we put on evidence. We brought in live witnesses. We knew the importance of putting on evidence. What I think Judge Roop was trying to say was that he's going to assume Ms. Hageman was negligent. The issue then is to apply the four-factor test. And so that's what I think he was trying to say.
But the question of discretion, whether there's a sign posted on the front of the headboard or not, cuts into not only the breach of the duty, but the existence of any ministerial duty to begin with.
And that's the only proffer they made was to that factor, was the judgment of discretion. They didn't proffer anything as to the other factors, Your Honors. But if you look at the limited proffer that Pike's counsel made, they did not proffer that there was some order on April 18th that said that not only did there have to be an absence of pressure, but the head had to be in a midline or neutral position. The only proffer they made on page 333 of the appendix was that, quote, this is her proffer. I have Pike's mother, Betty Tatum, and his stepfather, Earl Tatum, who both were clearly aware of the sign placed above his head that indicated that he was to be kept elevated without any pressure. There's no disagreement between the parties on that, Your Honor. We do agree that there was a standing order that said generally keep the pressure off the side of the head and that the head of the bed was to remain elevated. That was uncontradicted. That's the only proffer that they made in this case. And I would say that the court accepted that testimony. Now, there was undisputed testimony from multiple witnesses on our side that any order that went further than that was the day after. But what the court went a step further, because I guess the reason why they think that's so important is that would further or that would try to limit the discretion and judgment that would be involved. Because if there wasn't anything like that, I mean, what's pressure? How far do you bend the head? So they're trying to limit it. But the trial, as the trial court noted, even if you assume that that was somehow there, there was still fundamental judgment and discretion. This was not an order that's supposed to be there for 10 seconds. This was a standing order that had to last for days and days and days of how you're going to keep pressure off the neck and how you would, even assuming you had to have it in a neutral position. How do you accomplish that? I mean, the trial court showed several examples of the choices that you would have to have. There was testimony that was uncontradicted from Ms. Hageman and her nursing supervisor that she had discretion in how to accomplish that fact. I think it's very significant, Your Honor, when you look at this case, that while they say it's ministerial, they never once in any of their briefs or arguments suggest how Ms. Hageman, over a course of days, I mean the nursing, is supposed to enforce or implement that order, while also doing that, in effect, while she's performing triage. I mean, this is a person who had all kinds of orders and needs, management of care. This was one small part of what she was supposed to do.
Doesn't that cut against you, counsel? I mean, if this patient required minute-by-minute care because he was the sickest of the sick, then how is it that that his head was found in this unusual position?
Well, the allegation is that it is, Your Honor. I mean, the evidence hasn't been on that. But the issue isn't whether or not Ms. Hageman was
negligent. Don't we have to accept the allegation is true?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. But with every sovereign immunity case, you're assuming negligence occurred. I mean, the issue isn't for purposes of sovereign immunity, was Ms. Hageman negligent? The issue is, did she have judgment and discretion? Was she negligent in carrying out that judgment and discretion? So
well,
if you
actually,
look at the Ridley versus...
You actually touch upon something that I wanted to ask you to respond to as well. As you probably already know, I'm not a fan of an expansive reading of sovereign immunity.
Yes, sir.
I also only speak for one justice. But looking at Messina versus Burden, why should the defendant here be granted the special protection of immunity? What is it that takes this negligence out of the negligence that that occurs anywhere else?
Well, the first thing we would say is it fits squarely into the James v. Jane test. So, for example, if you look at the long precedent that this court has done, for example, you have a bus driver who, if she's transporting students, that is entitled to sovereign immunity. If you have someone who's operating a snowplow and putting down salt, that is special enough to warrant sovereign immunity. In this case, or a police officer responding to a car or a firefighter. In this case, you have Nurse Hageman who is trying to keep this person alive. I mean, she is tending to someone who is gravely, gravely ill. That seems to me...
That doesn't take it out of the case of any other nurse in any other hospital.
Well, it's from the policy standpoint. Our first point is that this court has said sovereign immunity is alive and well. And there's been a long line of cases on that. And at this point, we would submit that if sovereign immunity is going to be changed, it should be done in the halls of the General Assembly, not in this courtroom.
But in terms of the
policy, Your Honor, if you look at the policy issues of wanting to have to be able to attract high quality people to perform difficult tasks in government, and if you want them to be operating and performing those tasks in such a way that they're not fearful of lawsuits, two of the main principles behind sovereign immunity, you have Nurse Hageman, which is on the surgical trauma intensive care unit. As the evidence, I think, demonstrates, that's about as stressful a case and a job as you can possibly have when these people are so sick you have at most two patients at a time. And so this fits squarely into the policy behind sovereign immunity, Honor, that you don't want someone in Nurse Hageman's position to be worried about lawsuits or adverse outcomes or how it might impact her job.
You have a level one trauma hospital at Fairfax Hospital. It doesn't have sovereign immunity. Why should MD or UVA be treated differently?
Because the General Assembly, knowing James v. Jane and what is the essential mission, in 1996 a charter was adopted of both UVA and VCU, and the General Assembly spoke about what the essential missions are. And as this court has said, in looking at the case law, you want to see how important is this involvement by the General Assembly. And the General Assembly specifically, knowing the case law, in the charter of VCU Health Systems, said it was a couple of things. That
you
it was an essential
to,
mission.
So much of your brief related to that very paragraph.
Yes.
It seems that that was the answer to each of the questions. We're familiar with that paragraph. But does that mean that sovereign immunity is going to apply to anything and everything that happens at those two hospitals? That the General Assembly was intending to say that sovereign immunity is so alive and well that it covers these two hospitals like a blanket?
No, I think the General Assembly has said that UVA is not primarily intended to do general health care facility or specialized care. It's a teaching facility. That's why James v. Jane and a lot of the circuit court cases don't extend sovereign immunity. But in Lohr versus Larson, for example, you have to look at the intent of the institution and the purpose as explained by the General Assembly. And so we would submit that VCU Health, which is serving a large urban area with diverse needs, is far from just an educational facility like UVA. That's why it's different from UVA, Your Honor. So we think that you don't look at the UVA Center the same as VCU.
So in theory, VCU Hospital could be sued, the Commonwealth could be sued for negligence VCU Hospital had under the State Tort Claims Act.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
So that's the legislature's response to this policy debate is they've carved out an exception, they've made a pretty clear description of it, and that's where we are.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, the General Assembly has made that policy decision of how you proceed. And the Act specifically says if there's an employee like Nurse Hageman, you go under the Tort Claims Act.
Well, and is your argument that every MCV employee would be protected by sovereign immunity, or is it that people at this level of expertise and discretion are protected by sovereign immunity?
I think at this level, Your Honor, you would apply the four-factor test. And if you look at the case law, I think what this court is saying is you've got to look at the context. If the person is performing a function that is, it is central to the governmental mission that they're supposed to be carrying out, then that weighs in granting sovereign immunity. So you see the difference between a bus driver who's not carrying any children and a bus driver who is. If you look at the snowplow operator who's actually putting down the salt versus driving to where he's supposed to start. The court has said the closer you are to your mission, that would give you sovereign immunity if that's what you're performing. But if it's tangential, if I'm doing service of process, I've handed it off, and then I'm just driving out of the driveway, that's not really relating to your central mission. So, for example, in this case, if Ms. Hageman had just been walking down the hall and she wasn't paying attention to what she was doing and she tripped somebody, that probably wouldn't satisfy the James v. James test, because that's not in the context of the service that she's primarily supposed to be performing. But in this case, what she was doing, her main mission was to be a nurse providing nursing care. And that is exactly what the alleged negligence arose out of, treating this person. So that's why we think it's directly related to the Lentz case, for example, the school teacher, the firefighter, the snowplow. She's performing her nursing function, which requires judgment and discretion. So I think, Justice Mims, I've spent time on the first and second factors of why we say with VCU Health, the General Assembly has declared what their interest is in their performing a general facility and specialized services. I would note she's on the surgical trauma intensive care unit. That is a specialized service, and as the testimony reflected, that being in the STICU, the intensive care unit, was an integral part of being able to perform those highly complex and difficult surgeries. They're part of the team. So it means
keeping someone's head stable that complex?
I believe
it seems like routine care to me.
It's twofold, Your Honor. One is, I don't think you can parse it out to that level of is she performing the care that VCU is supposed to render. One, yes, as the general care. But two, that's part and parcel of carrying out all those complex orders. One of the orders is to keep pressure off the vicinity for days and days on end. I mean, how do you do that? Do you use a halo? Do you let that off? Are you, as you're bringing the patient off sedation, how much do you involve them? Do you rely on the family? Are you supposed to watch them 24 hours a day just where the neck is? That's a series of decisions. But as in the Whitley versus Commonwealth case, I mean, this court noted that while some of the duties would seem to be ministerial, the court emphasized you've got to look at the context. It's not like Ms. Hageman in this case. The only thing she had to do, Your Honor, was look at the man's head. I think the evidence reflects of how intensive the care of this man, from wound care to maintaining his ventilator to all the series of complex orders. She's doing that at the same time while she's trying to carry out that order. We would submit that that is not something that the ordinary public would be expected to do. And that's what the case law looks like. If I'm just driving, there's no special circumstance. That's something anybody can do. But she is doing this in the context of taking care of this man who's very, very sick. And I don't think you can slice it so thin and ignore everything else that Ms. Hageman has to do when you're looking at this. Your Honor, I would also note that we think the evidence is very clear. There was only one order, and I think they should have signed error if they thought somehow they were prejudiced. But as I indicated, they didn't proffer anything above keep the pressure off the area and keep the head of the bed elevated. I know that my time is almost up. I'd be delighted to answer any other questions. But this is clearly. Under James v. Jane, and if the law is to change, we submit the General Assembly should do it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Quinn.
Yes, Your Honor. I would point out in rebuttal that my client was 5 days out of reconstructive surgery. He was not gravely, gravely ill. He was in recovery, and he was doing well until he was watched by Nurse Hageman. The evidence is clear. The factual findings are very clear that she was instructed to make sure there was no pressure kept on my client's neck and head on the right side in the area of where the surgery was so that you did not have venous compromise. The pressure had to have been there for an extended period of time in order to cause venous compromise. There was no evidence put on whatsoever as to what judgment and discretion she had to use just to simply make sure there was no pressure kept to that area of the head and that his head was kept up. And
Can I interrupt you again? Is it right that the proffer is limited, the sign proffer is limited to keeping the head elevated and that there be no pressure, as opposed to putting on a halo or fixing the head in a particular vertical position or anything more specific? That was the proffer, is that right?
That was the proffer, but Judge Roop had previously indicated that he was going to accept what we had stated in the complaint as well, which was that the head was to be kept erect, etc. And so since he had reiterated that several times...
But the proffer of the witness at the evidentiary hearing, I mean, this is a plea and bar hearing, this is an evidentiary hearing. You could have asked for a jury if you wanted it. The evidence that's in the evidentiary record is, but I need you to correct me if I've got this wrong, a single proffer that the head should be elevated, the bed should be elevated, and that there be, quote, no pressure on the wound site, apparently.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's very different from keeping the head in a particular vertical upright position without any, you know, 5% degree change one way or the other, or use this or that or the other restraint.
Your Honor, we never proffered any evidence about using this restraint or that restraint or any other restraint. We simply said that it's a common sense that you keep somebody in a position so that they're not slumped over the bed
rail.
Right,
but the court specifically says even if keeping Pike's head erect was a direct order, the method of doing so was within Hageman's judgment and discretion. So under the standard of review, how do we deal with that?
Because the court just reaches a conclusory that judgment and discretion is a matter of law. There was no evidence that said she specifically had to use a halo or but these were all the different things that she could have done. It was common sense. She had two patients at most, and she couldn't remember she had a second patient. She didn't have all these other orders and things to do. At MCB, the patients are typically side by side, and so she's got this patient she's got to keep an eye on. Even if she has another patient, she's just looking back and forth at the two of them, and so she's not running off and doing a bunch of other things throughout her day. She's got to make sure the man's not slumped over his bed rail with the neck hanging at the suture site, at the site where the venous compromise is, that's been is left there for such an extended period of time that it's going to cause the surgery to fail. I don't think that requires much in the way of judgment and discretion. It's no different than a nurse caring for any patient and making sure they don't fall out of bed or end up in a dangerous position that's dangerous to themselves.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank
Call
you.
The next case.